and he liked poetry, Robert Frost's particularly, but he also admired Whitman, Emily Dickinson, and the comic poems of Ogden Nash. Though the quenchless quality of his literary thirst had soon depleted the shelves of the prison library, the prison chaplain and others sympathetic to Andrews kept him supplied with parcels from the Kansas City Public Library. Dick was rather a bookworm, too. But his interest was restricted to two themes. Sex, as represented in the novels of Harold Robbins and Irving Wallace. Perry, after being lent one of these by Dick, returned it with an indignant note. Degenerate filth for filthy degenerate minds. And law literature. He consumed hours each day leafing through law books, compiling research that he hoped would help reverse his conviction. Also, in pursuit of the same cause, he fired off a cannonade of letters to such organizations as the American Civil Liberties Union and the Kansas State Bar Association. Letters attacking his trial as a travesty of due process, and urging the recipients to aid him in his quest for a new trial. Perry was persuaded to draft similar pleas, but when Dick suggested that Andy follow their example by writing protests in his own behalf, Andrews replied, "I'll worry about my neck, and you worry about yours." Actually, Dick's neck was not the part of his anatomy that most immediately troubled him. "My hair is coming out by the handfuls," he confided in yet another letter to his mother. "I'm frantic. Nobody in our family was bald-headed as I can recall, and it makes me frantic the idea of being an ugly old bald-head." The Rose two night guards, arriving at work on an autumn evening in 1961, had a piece of news. "Well," one of them announced, "seems like you boys can expect company." The import of the remark was clear to his audience. It meant that two young soldiers, who had been standing trial for the murder of a Kansas railroad worker, had received the ultimate sentence. "Yes, sir," the guard said, confirming this. "They got the death penalty." Dick said, "Sure. It's very popular in Kansas. Juries handed out like they were giving candy to kids." One of the soldiers, George Ronald York, was 18. His companion, James Douglas Latham, was a year older. They were both exceptionally personable, which perhaps explains why hordes of teenaged girls had attended their trial. Though convicted of a single slaying, the pair had claimed seven victims in the course of a cross-country murder spree. Ronnie York, blonde and blue-eyed, had been born and raised in Florida, where his father was a well-known, well-paid deep-sea diver. The Yorks had a pleasantly comfortable home life, and Ronnie, overloved and overpraised by his parents and a worshipful younger sister, was the adored center of it. Latham's background was at the opposite extreme, being every bit as bleak as Perry Smith's. Born in Texas, he was the youngest child of fertile, moneyless, embattled parents who, when finally they separated, left their progeny to fend for themselves, to scatter hither and thither, loose and unwanted as bundles of panhandle tumbleweed. At 17, in need of a refuge, Latham enlisted in the Army. 2 years later, found guilty of an AWOL offense, he was imprisoned in the stockade at Fort Hood, Texas. It was there that he met Ronnie York, who was also under sentence for having gone AWOL. Though they were very unlike, even physically, York being tall and phlegmatic, whereas the Texan was a short young man with foxy brown eyes animating a compact, cute little face, they found they shared at least one firm opinion. The world was hateful, and everybody in it would be better off dead. "It's a rotten world," Latham said. "There's no answer to it but meanness. That's all anybody understands. Meanness. Burn down the man's barn. He'll understand that. Poison his dog. Kill him." Ronnie said Latham was 100% correct, adding, "Anyway, anybody you kill, you're doing them a favor." The first person they chose to sow favor were two Georgia women, respectable housewives who had the misfortune to encounter York and Latham not long after the murderous pair escaped from the Fort Hood stockade, stole a pickup truck, and drove to Jacksonville, Florida, York's hometown. The scene of the encounter was an Esso station on the dark outskirts of Jacksonville. The date was the night of May 29, 1961. Originally, the absconding soldiers had traveled to the Florida city with the intention of visiting York's family. Once there, however, York decided it might be unwise to contact his parents. His father sometimes had quite a temper. He and Latham talked it over, and New Orleans was their new destination when they stopped at the Esso station to buy gas. Alongside them, another car was imbibing fuel. It contained the two matronly victims-to-be, who, after a day of shopping and pleasure in Jacksonville, were returning to their homes in a small town near the Florida-Georgia border. Alas, they had lost their way. York, from whom they asked directions, was most obliging. "You just follow us. We'll put you on the right road." But the road to which he led them was very wrong indeed. A narrow side turning that petered off into swamp. Nevertheless, the ladies followed along faithfully until the lead vehicle halted, and they saw, in the shine of their headlights, the helpful young men approaching them on foot, and saw, but too late, that each was armed with a black bullwhip. The whips were the property of the stolen truck's rightful custodian, a cattleman. It had been Latham's notion to use them as garrotes, which, after robbing the women, is what they did. In New Orleans, the boys bought a pistol and carved two notches in the handle. During the next 10 days, notches were added in Tullahoma, Tennessee, where they acquired a snappy red Dodge convertible by shooting the owner, a traveling salesman, and in an Illinois suburb of St. Louis, where two more men were slain. The Kansas victim, who followed the preceding five, was a grandfather. His name was Otto Ziegler. He was 62, a robust, friendly fellow, the sort not likely to pass distressed motorists without offering assistance. While spinning along a Kansas highway one fine June morning, Mr. Ziegler spied a red convertible parked by the roadside, its hood up, and a couple of nice-looking youngsters fiddling with the motor. How was the good-hearted Mr. Ziegler to know that nothing ailed the machine? That this was a ruse devised to rob and kill would-be Samaritans? His last words were, "Anything I can do?" York, at a distance of 20 feet, sent a bullet crashing through the old man's skull, then turned to Latham and said, "Pretty good shooting, huh?" Their final victim was the most pathetic. It was a girl, only 18. She was employed as a maid in a Colorado motel where the rampaging pair spent a night, during which she let them make love to her. Then they told her they were on their way to California and invited her to come along. "Come on," Latham urged her. "Maybe we'll all end up movie stars." The girl and her hastily packed cardboard suitcase ended up as blood-soaked wreckage at the bottom of a ravine near Craig, Colorado. But not many hours after she had been shot and thrown there, her assassins were in fact performing before motion picture cameras. Descriptions of the red car's occupants, provided by witnesses who had noticed them loitering in the area where Otto Ziegler's body was discovered, had been circulated through the Midwest and Western states. Roadblocks were erected, and helicopters patrolled the highways. It was a roadblock in Utah that caught York and Latham. Later, at police headquarters in Salt Lake City, a local television company was allowed to film an interview with them. The result, if viewed without sound, would seem to concern two cheerful, milk-fed athletes discussing hockey or baseball. Anything but murder and the roles, boastfully confessed, they had played in the deaths of 7 people. "Why," the interviewer asks, "why did you do it?" And York, with a self-congratulatory grin, answers, "We hate the world." All 5 of the states that vied for the right to prosecute York and Latham endorse judicial homicide. Florida, electrocution. Tennessee, electrocution. Illinois, electrocution. Kansas, hanging. And Colorado, lethal gas. But because it had the firmest evidence, Kansas was victorious. The men on the row first met their new companions November 2, 1961. A guard, escorting the arrivals to their cells, introduced them. "Mr. York, Mr. Latham, I'd like you to know Mr. Smith here, and Mr. Hickok, and Mr. Lowell Lee Andrews, the nicest boy in Walcott." When the parade had passed, Hickok heard Andrews chuckling and said, "What's so funny about that son of a bitch?"
"Nothing," Andrews said. "But I was thinking. When you count my three and your four and their seven, that makes 14 of them and 5 of us. Now 5 into 14 averages out 4 into 14, Hickok curtly corrected him. "There are 4 killers up here and 1 railroaded man. I'm no goddamn killer. I never touched a hair on a human head."
Hickok continued writing letters protesting his conviction, and one of these at last bore fruit. The recipient, Everett Stearman, chairman of the Legal Aid Committee of the Kansas State Bar Association, was disturbed by the allegations of the sender, who insisted that he and his co-defendant had not had a fair trial. According to Hickok, the hostile atmosphere in Garden City had made it impossible to impanel an unbiased jury, and therefore a change of venue should have been granted. As for the jurors that were chosen, at least 2 had clearly indicated a presumption of guilt during the voir dire examination. When asked to state his opinion of capital punishment, one man said that ordinarily he was against it, but in this case, no. Unfortunately, the voir dire had not been recorded because Kansas law does not require it unless a specific demand is made. Many of the jurors, moreover, were well acquainted with the deceased. So was the judge. Judge Tate was an intimate friend of Mr. Clutter. But the bulkiest of Hickok's mud pies was aimed at the 2 defense attorneys, Arthur Fleming and Harrison Smith, whose incompetence and inadequacy were the chief cause of the correspondent's present predicament, for no real defense had been prepared or offered by them, and this lack of effort, it was implied, had been deliberate, an act of collusion between the defense and the prosecution. These were grave assertions, reflecting upon the integrity of 2 respected lawyers and a distinguished district judge. But if even partially true, then the constitutional rights of the defendants had been abused. Prompted by Mr. Stearman, the Bar Association undertook a course of action without precedent in Kansas legal history. It appointed a young Wichita attorney, Russell Schultz, to investigate the charges and, should evidence warrant it, challenge the validity of the conviction by bringing habeas corpus proceedings in the Kansas Supreme Court, which had recently upheld the verdict. It would appear that Schultz's investigation was rather one-sided, since it consisted of little more than an interview with Smith and Hickok, from which the lawyer emerged with crusading phrases for the press. The question is this: do poor, plainly guilty defendants have a right to a complete defense? I do not believe that the state of Kansas would be either greatly or for long harmed by the death of these appellants. But I do not believe it could ever recover from the death of due process. Schultz filed his habeas corpus petition, and the Kansas Supreme Court commissioned one of its own retired justices, the Honorable Walter G. Thiel, to conduct a full-scale hearing. And so it came to pass that almost 2 years after the trial, the whole cast reassembled in the courtroom at Garden City. The only important participants absent were the original defendants. In their stead, as it were, stood Judge Tate, old Mr. Fleming, and Harrison Smith, whose careers were imperiled. Not because of the appellant's allegations per se, but because of the apparent credit the Bar Association bestowed upon them. The hearing, which at one point was transferred to Lansing, where Judge Thiel heard Smith and Hickok testify, took 6 days to complete. Ultimately, every point was covered. 8 jurors swore they had never known any member of the slain family. 4 admitted some slight acquaintance with Mr. Clutter, but each, including N. L. Dunnan, the airport operator who had made the controversial reply during the voir dire, testified that he had entered the jury box with an unprejudiced mind. Schultz challenged Dunnan. "Do you feel, sir, that you would have been willing to go to trial with a juror whose state of mind was the same as yours?" Dunnan said yes, he would. And Schultz then said, "Do you recall being asked whether or not you were averse to capital punishment?" Nodding, the witness answered, "I told them under normal conditions I would probably be averse to it. But with the magnitude of this crime, I could probably vote in favor."
Tangling with Tate was more difficult. Schultz soon realized he had a tiger by the tail. Responding to questions relevant to his supposed intimacy with Mr. Clutter, the judge said he, Clutter, was once a litigant in this court, a case over which I presided, a damage action involving an airplane falling on his property. He was suing for damages to, I believe, some fruit trees. Other than that, I had no occasion to associate with him. None whatever. I saw him perhaps once or twice in the course of a year. Schultz, floundering, switched the subject. Do you know, he asked, what the attitude of the people was in this community after the apprehension of these two men? I believe I do, the judge told him with scathing confidence. It is my opinion that the attitude toward them was that of anyone else charged with a criminal offense, that they should be tried as the law provides, that if they were guilty, they should be convicted, that they should be given the same fair treatment as any other person. There was no prejudice against them because they were accused of crime. You mean, Schultz slyly said, you saw no reason for the court on its own motion to grant a change of venue? Tate's lips curved downward. His eyes blazed. Mr. Schultz, he said, as though the name was a prolonged hiss. The court cannot, on its own, grant a change of venue. That would be contrary to Kansas law. I couldn't grant a change unless it was properly requested. But why had such a request not been made by the defendant's attorneys? Schultz now pursued this question with the attorneys themselves, for to discredit them and prove that they had not supplied their clients with the minimum protection was, from the Wichita lawyer's viewpoint, the hearing's principal objective. Fleming and Smith withstood the onslaught in good style, particularly Fleming, who, wearing a bold red tie and an abiding smile, endured Schultz with gentlemanly resignation. Explaining why he had not applied for a change of venue, he said, I felt that since the Reverend Cohen, the minister of the Methodist Church, and a man of substance here, a man of high standing, as well as many other ministers here, had expressed themselves against capital punishment, that at least the leaven had been cast in the area, and there were likely more people here inclined to be lenient in the matter of the penalty than perhaps in other parts of the state. Then I believe it was a brother of Mrs. Clutter's who made a statement that appeared in the press indicating he did not feel the defendants should be put to death. Schultz had a score of charges, but underlying them all was the implication that because of community pressure, Fleming and Smith had deliberately neglected their duties. Both men, Schultz maintained, had betrayed their clients by not consulting with them sufficiently. Mr. Fleming replied, I worked on the case to the very best of my ability, giving it more time than I do most cases, by waiving a preliminary hearing. Smith answered, But, sir, neither Mr. Fleming nor I had been appointed counsel at the time of the waiver. By making remarks to newsmen damaging to the defendants. Schultz to Smith. Are you aware that a reporter, Ron Cull of the Topeka Daily Capital, quoted you on the second day of the trial as saying there was no doubt of Mr. Hickok's guilt, but that you were concerned only with obtaining life imprisonment rather than the death penalty? Smith to Schultz. No, sir. If I was quoted as saying that, it was incorrect. And by failing to prepare a proper defense. This last proposition was the one Schultz peddled hardest. It is relevant, therefore, to reproduce an opinion of it written by three federal judges as the result of a subsequent appeal to the United States Court of Appeals, 10th Circuit. We think, however, that those viewing the situation in retrospect have lost sight of the problems which confronted attorneys Smith and Fleming when they undertook the defense of these petitioners. When they accepted the appointments, each petitioner had made a full confession, and they did not then contend, nor did they seriously contend at any time in the state courts, that these confessions were not voluntary.
A radio taken from the Clutter home and sold by the petitioners in Mexico City had been recovered, and the attorneys knew of other evidence of their guilt then in the possession of the prosecution. When called upon to plead to the charges against them, they stood mute, and it was necessary for the court to enter a plea of not guilty for them. There was no substantial evidence then, and none has been produced since the trial to substantiate a defense of insanity. The attempt to establish insanity as a defense because of serious injuries in accidents years before, and headaches and occasional fainting spells of hiccough, was like grasping at the proverbial straw. The attorneys were faced with a situation where outrageous crimes committed on innocent persons had been admitted. Under these circumstances, they would have been justified in advising that petitioners enter pleas of guilty and throw themselves on the mercy of the court. Their only hope was through some turn of fate, the lives of these misguided individuals might be spared. In the report he submitted to the Kansas Supreme Court, Judge Thiel found that the petitioners had received a constitutionally fair trial. The court thereupon denied the writ to abolish the verdict and set a new date of execution, October 25, 1962. As it happened, Lowell Lee Andrews, whose case had twice traveled all the way to the United States Supreme Court, was scheduled to hang 1 month later. The Clutter Slayers, granted a reprieve by a federal judge, evaded their date. Andrews kept his. In the disposition of capital cases in the United States, the median elapsed time between sentence and execution is approximately 17 months. Recently, in Texas, an armed robber was electrocuted 1 month after his conviction. But in Louisiana, at the present writing, two rapists have been waiting for a record 12 years. The variance depends a little on luck and a great deal on the extent of litigation. The majority of the lawyers handling these cases are court-appointed and work without recompense. But more often than not, the courts, in order to avoid future appeals based on complaints of inadequate representation, appoint men of first quality who defend with commendable vigor. However, even an attorney of moderate talent can postpone doomsday year after year, for the system of appeals that pervades American jurisprudence amounts to a legalistic wheel of fortune, a game of chance, somewhat fixed in the favor of the criminal, that the participants play interminably, first in the state courts, then through the federal courts, until the ultimate tribunal is reached, the United States Supreme Court. But even defeat there does not signify if petitioner's counsel can discover or invent new grounds for appeal. Usually they can, and so once more the wheel turns, and turns until, perhaps some years later, the prisoner arrives back at the nation's highest court, probably only to begin again the slow, cruel contest. But at intervals the wheel does pause to declare a winner. Or, though with increasing rarity, a loser. Andrew's lawyers fought to the final moment, but their client went to the gallows on Friday, November 30th, 1962. That was a cold night, Hickok said, talking to a journalist with whom he corresponded and who was periodically allowed to visit him. Cold and wet. It had been raining like a bastard, and the baseball field was mud up to your cojones. So when they took Andy out to the warehouse, they had to walk him along the path. We were all at our windows watching. Perry and me, Ronnie York, Jimmy Latham. It was just after midnight, and the warehouse was lit up like a Halloween pumpkin. The doors wide open. We could see the witnesses, a lot of guards, the doctor and the warden. Every damn thing but the gallows. It was off at an angle, but we could see its shadow. A shadow on the wall, like the shadow of a boxing ring. The chaplain and four guards had charge of Andy, and when they got to the door they stopped a second. Andy was looking at the gallows. You could sense he was. His arms were tied in front of him. All of a sudden, the chaplain reached out and took off Andy's glasses. Which was kind of pitiful. Andy without his glasses.
They led him on inside, and I wondered he could see to climb the steps. It was real quiet. Just nothing but this dog barking way off. Some town dog. Then we heard it. The sound. And Jimmy Latham said, "What was that?" And I told him what it was. The trap door. Then it was real quiet again. Except that dog. Old Andy, he danced a long time. They must have had a real mess to clean up. Every few minutes, the doctor came to the door and stepped outside and stood there with this stethoscope in his hand. I wouldn't say he was enjoying his work. Kept gasping like he was gasping for breath, and he was crying, too. Jimmy said, "Get a load of that, Nance." I guess the reason he stepped outside was so the others wouldn't see he was crying. Then he'd go back and listen to hear if Andy's heart had stopped. Seemed like it never would. The fact is, his heart kept beating for 19 minutes. Andy was a funny kid, Hickok said, smiling lopsidedly as he propped a cigarette between his lips. It was like I told him. He had no respect for human life, not even his own. Right before they hanged him, he sat down and ate 2 fried chickens. And that last afternoon, he was smoking cigars and drinking Coke and writing poetry. When they came to get him, and we said our goodbye, I said, "I'll be seeing you soon, Andy. 'Cause I'm sure we're going to the same place. So scout around and see if you can't find a cool, shady spot for us down there." He laughed and said he didn't believe in heaven or hell, just dust unto dust. And he said an aunt and uncle had been to see him and told him they had a coffin waiting to carry him to some little cemetery in North Missouri, the same place where the 3 he disposed of were buried. They planned to put Andy right alongside them. He said when they told him that, he could hardly keep a straight face. I said, "Well, you're lucky to have a grave. Most likely they'll give Perry and me to the vivisectionist." We joked on like that till it was time to go. And just as he was going, he handed me a piece of paper with a poem on it. I don't know if he wrote it or copied it out of a book. My impression was he wrote it. If you're interested, I'll send it to you. He later did so, and Andrew's farewell message turned out to be the 9th stanza of Gray's Elegy Written in a Country Churchyard. The boasts of heraldry, the pomp of power, and all that beauty, all that wealth e'er gave, await alike the inevitable hour. The paths of glory lead but to the grave. I really liked Andy. He was a nut. Not a real nut, like they kept hollering. But, you know, just goofy. He was always talking about breaking out of here and making his living as a hired gun. He liked to imagine himself roaming around Chicago or Los Angeles with a machine gun inside a violin case. Cooling guys. Said he'd charge $1,000 per stiff. Hickok laughed, presumably at the absurdity of his friend's ambitions, sighed, and shook his head. But for someone his age, he was the smartest person I ever come across. A human library. When that boy read a book, it stayed read. Of course, he didn't know a dumb darn thing about life. Me, I'm an ignoramus except when it comes to what I know about life. I've walked along a lot of mean streets. I've seen a white man flogged. I've watched babies born. I've seen a girl, and her no more than 14, take on 3 guys at the same time and give them all their money's worth. Fell off a ship once, 5 miles out to sea. Swam 5 miles with my life passing before me with every stroke. Once I shook hands with President Truman in the lobby of the Hotel Muehlbach. Harry S. Truman. When I was working for the hospital, driving an ambulance, I saw every side of life there is. Things that would make a dog vomit. But Andy, he didn't know one dumb, damn, darn thing except what he'd read in books. He was innocent as a little child. Some kid with a box of Cracker Jack. He'd never once been with a woman. Man or mule. He said so himself. Maybe that's what I liked about him most. How he wouldn't prevaricate. The rest of us on the row, we're all a bunch of bull artists. I'm one of the worst. Shoot, you've got to talk about something. Brag. Otherwise you're nobody. Nothing. A potato vegetating in your 7x10 limbo. But Andy never would partake. He said, what's the use telling a lot of stuff that never happened? Old Perry, though. He wasn't sorry to see the last of Andy. Andy was the one thing in the world Perry wants to be. Educated. And Perry couldn't forgive him for it. You know how Perry's always using $100 words he doesn't half know the meaning of? Sounds like one of them college niggers. Boy, it burned his bottom to have Andy catch up on him and haul him to the curb. Of course, Andy was just trying to give him what he wanted. An education. The truth is, can't anybody get along with Perry? He hasn't got a single friend on the premises. I mean, just who the hell does he think he is? Sneering at everybody. Calling people perverts and degenerates. Going on about what low IQs they have. It's too bad we can't all be such sensitive souls like little Perry. Saints. Boy, but I know some hard rocks who'd gladly go to the corner if they could get him alone in the shower room for just one hot minute. The way he hi-hats York and Latham. Ronnie says he sure wishes he knew where he could lay hold of a bullwhip. Says he'd like to squeeze Perry a little. I don't blame him. After all, we're all in the same fix, and they're pretty good boys. Hickok chuckled ruefully, shrugged, and said, you know what I mean. Good, considering. Ronnie York's mother has been here to visit him several times. One day, out in the waiting room, she met my mother, and now they've come to be each other's number one buddy. Mrs. York wants my mother to come visit her home in Florida, maybe even live there. Jesus, I wish she would. Then she wouldn't have to go through this ordeal. Once a month, riding the bus here to see me. Smiling. Trying to find something to say. Make me feel good. The poor lady. I don't know how she stands it. I wonder she isn't crazy. Hickok's uneven eyes turned toward a window in the visiting room. His face, puffy, pallid as a funeral lily, gleamed in the weak winter sunshine filtering through the bar-shrouded glass. The poor lady. She wrote the warden and asked him if she could speak to Perry the next time she came here. She wanted to hear from Perry himself how he killed those people, how I never fired shot one. All I can hope is that someday we'll get a new trial, and Perry will testify and tell the truth. Only I doubt it. He's plain determined that if he goes, I go. Back to back. It's not right. Many a man has killed and never seen the inside of a death cell. And I never killed anybody. If you've got $50,000 to spend, you could bump off half of Kansas City and just laugh, ha ha. A sudden grin obliterated his woeful indignation. Uh-oh. There I go again. Old crybaby. You'd think I'd learn. But honest to God, I've done my damnedest to get along with Perry. Only he's so critical. Two-faced. So jealous of every little thing. Every letter I get. Every visit. Nobody ever comes to see him except you, he said, nodding at the journalist, who was as equally well acquainted with Smith as he was with Hickok. Or his lawyer. Remember when he was in the hospital? With that phony starvation routine? And his dad sent the postcard? Well, the warden wrote Perry's dad and said he was welcome to come here anytime. but he never has showed up. I don't know. Sometimes you got to feel sorry for Perry. He must be one of the most alone people there ever was. But, oh, the hell with him. It's mostly every bit his own fault. Hickok slipped another cigarette away from a package of Pall Malls, wrinkled his nose, and said, I've tried to quit smoking. Then I figure what difference does it make under the circumstances? With a little luck, maybe I'll get cancer and beat the state at its own game. For a while there, I was smoking cigars. Andy's. The morning after they hanged him, I woke up and called to him, Andy, the way I usually did. Then I remembered he was on his way to Missouri, with the aunt and uncle. I looked out in the corridor. His cell had been cleaned out, and all his junk was piled there. The mattress off his bunk, his slippers, and the scrapbook with all the food pictures. He called it his icebox. And this box of Macbeth cigars. I told the guard Andy wanted me to have them, left them to me in his will. Actually, I never smoked them all. Maybe it was the idea of Andy, but somehow they gave me indigestion. Well, what's there to say about capital punishment? I'm not against it. Revenge is all it is, but what's wrong with revenge? It's very important. If I was kin to the Clutters, or any of the parties York and Latham dispensed with, I couldn't rest in peace till the ones responsible had taken that ride on the big swing. These people that write letters to the newspapers. There were two in a Topeka paper the other day. One from a minister, saying, in effect, what is all this legal farce? Why haven't those sons of bitches Smith and Hickok got it in the neck? How come those murdering sons of bitches are still eating up the taxpayers' money? Well, I can see their side. They're mad 'cause they're not getting what they want. Revenge. And they're not going to get it if I can help it. I believe in hanging. Just so long as I'm not the one being hanged. But then, he was. Another 3 years passed, and during those years, two exceptionally skillful Kansas City lawyers, Joseph P. Jenkins and Robert Bingham, replaced Schultz, the latter having resigned from the case. Appointed by a federal judge and working without compensation, but motivated by a hard-held opinion that the defendants had been the victims of a nightmarishly unfair trial, Jenkins and Bingham filed numerous appeals within the framework of the federal court system, thereby avoiding three execution dates, October 25, 1962, August 8, 1963, and February 18, 1965. The attorneys contended that their clients had been unjustly convicted because legal counsel had not been appointed them until after they had confessed and had waived preliminary hearings, and because they were not competently represented at their trial, were convicted with the help of evidence seized without a search warrant. The shotgun and knife taken from the Hickok home were not granted a change of venue, even though the environs of the trial had been saturated with publicity prejudicial to the accused. With these arguments, Jenkins and Bingham succeeded in carrying the case three times to the United States Supreme Court, the big boy, as many litigating prisoners refer to it. But on each occasion, the court, which never comments on its decisions in such instances, denied the appeals by refusing to grant the writs of certiorari that would have entitled the appellants to a full hearing before the court. In March 1965, after Smith and Hickok had been confined in their death row cells almost 2,000 days, the Kansas Supreme Court decreed that their lives must end between midnight and 2 a.m., Wednesday, April 14, 1965. Subsequently, a clemency appeal was presented to the newly elected governor of Kansas, William Avery. But Avery, a rich farmer sensitive to public opinion, refused to intervene. A decision he felt to be in the best interest of the people of Kansas.
2 months later, Avery also denied the clemency appeals of York and Latham, who were hanged on June 22, 1965. And so it happened that in the daylight hours of that Wednesday morning, Alvin Dewey, breakfasting in the coffee shop of a Topeka hotel, read, on the first page of the Kansas City Star, a headline he had long awaited. Die on Rope for Bloody Crime. The story, written by an Associated Press reporter, began, Richard Eugene Hickok and Perry Edward Smith, partners in crime, died on the gallows at the state prison early today for one of the bloodiest murders in Kansas criminal annals. Hickok, 33 years old, died first at 12:41 a.m. Smith, 36, died at 1:19. Dewey had watched them die, for he had been among the 20-odd witnesses invited to the ceremony. He had never attended an execution, and when, on the midnight past, he entered the cold warehouse, the scenery had surprised him. He had anticipated a setting of suitable dignity, not this bleakly lighted cavern cluttered with lumber and other debris. But the gallows itself, with its two pale nooses attached to a crossbeam, was imposing enough. And so, in an unexpected style, was the hangman, who cast a long shadow from his perch on the platform at the top of the wooden instrument's 13 steps. The hangman, an anonymous, leathery gentleman who had been imported from Missouri for the event, for which he was paid $600, was attired in an aged, double-breasted, pin-striped suit, overly commodious for the narrow figure inside it. The coat came nearly to his knees, and on his head he wore a cowboy hat which, when first bought, had perhaps been bright green, but was now a weathered, sweat-stained oddity. Also, Dewey found the self-consciously casual conversation of his fellow witnesses, as they stood awaiting the start of what one witness termed the festivities, disconcerting.
What I heard was, they was gonna let them draw straws to see who dropped first, or flip a coin. But Smith says why not do it alphabetically? Guess 'cause S comes after H. Ha!
Read in the paper, afternoon paper, what they ordered for their last meal?
Ordered the same menu.
Shrimp, French fries, garlic bread, ice cream and strawberries and whipped cream. Understand Smith didn't touch his much. That Hickok's got a sense of humor. They was telling me how, about an hour ago, one of the guards says to him, this must be the longest night of your life. And Hickok, he laughs and says, no, the shortest.
Did you hear about Hickok's eyes?
He left them to an eye doctor.
Soon as they cut him down, this doctor's gonna yank out his eyes and stick them in somebody else's head.
Can't say I'd want to be that somebody. I'd feel peculiar with them eyes in my head.
Christ! Is that rain? All the windows down. My new Chevy. Christ!
The sudden rain wrapped the high warehouse roof. The sound, not unlike the rat-a-tat-tat of parade drums, heralded Hickok's arrival. Accompanied by 6 guards and a prayer-murmuring chaplain, he entered the death place handcuffed and wearing an ugly harness of leather straps that bound his arms to his torso. At the foot of the gallows, the warden read to him the official order of execution, a 2-page document, and as the warden read, Hickok's eyes, enfeebled by half a decade of cell shadows, roamed the little audience until, not seeing what he sought, he asked the nearest guard in a whisper if any member of the Clutter family was present. When he was told no, the prisoner seemed disappointed, as though he thought the protocol surrounding this ritual of vengeance was not being properly observed. As is customary, the warden, having finished his recitation, asked the condemned man whether he had any last statement to make. Hickok nodded.
I just want to say I hold no hard feelings. You people are sending me to a better world than this ever was.
Then, as if to emphasize the point, he shook hands with the 4 men mainly responsible for his capture and conviction, all of whom had requested permission to attend the executions. KBI agents Roy Church, Clarence Dunce, Harold Nye, and Dewey himself. "Nice to see you," Hickok said with his most charming smile. It was as if he were greeting guests at his own funeral. The hangman coughed, impatiently lifted his cowboy hat and settled it again, a gesture somehow reminiscent of a turkey buzzard huffing, then smoothing its neck feathers. And Hickok, nudged by an attendant, mounted the scaffold steps. "The Lord giveth, the Lord taketh away. Blessed is the name of the Lord," the chaplain intoned, as the rain's sound accelerated, as the noose was fitted, and as a delicate black mask was tied round the prisoner's eyes. "May the Lord have mercy on your soul." The trap door opened, and Hickok hung for all to see a full 20 minutes before the prison doctor at last said, "I pronounce this man dead." A hearse, its blazing headlights beaded with rain, drove into the warehouse, and the body, placed on a litter and shrouded under a blanket, was carried to the hearse and out into the night. Staring after it, Roy Church shook his head. "I never would have believed he had the guts to take it like he did. I had him tagged a coward." The man to whom he spoke, another detective, said, "Aw, Roy, the guy was a punk, a mean bastard. He deserved it." Church, with thoughtful eyes, continued to shake his head. While waiting for the second execution, a reporter and a guard conversed. The reporter said, "This your first hanging?"
"I seen Lee Andrews."
"This here's my first."
"Yeah? How'd you like it?"
The reporter pursed his lips.
"Nobody in our office wanted the assignment."
"Me either.
But it wasn't as bad as I thought it would be. Just like jumping off a diving board.
Only with a rope around your neck.
They don't feel nothing. Drop, snap, and that's it. They don't feel nothing."
"Are you sure?"
"I was standing right close. I could hear him gasping for breath."
"Uh-huh, but he don't feel nothing. Wouldn't be humane if he did."
"Well, and I suppose they feed them a lot of pills. Sedatives?"
"Hell no. Against the rules." "Here comes Smith."
"Gosh, I didn't know he was such a shrimp."
"Yeah, he's little. But so is a tarantula."
As he was brought into the warehouse, Smith recognized his old foe, Dewey. He stopped chewing a hunk of double mint gum he had in his mouth and grinned and winked at Dewey, jaunty and mischievous. But after the warden asked if he had anything to say, his expression was sober. His sensitive eyes gazed gravely at the surrounding faces, swerved up to the shadowy hangman, then downward to his own manacled hands. He looked at his fingers, which were stained with ink and paint, for he'd spent his final 3 years on death row painting self-portraits and pictures of children, usually the children of inmates who supplied him with photographs of their seldom-seen progeny.
"I think," he said, "it's a hell of a thing to take a life in this manner. I don't believe in capital punishment, morally or legally. Maybe I had something to contribute. Something..."
His assurance faltered. Shyness blurred his voice, lowered it to a just audible level.
"It would be meaningless to apologize for what I did. Even inappropriate. But I do. I apologize."
Steps, noose, mask. But before the mask was adjusted, the prisoner spat his chewing gum into the chaplain's outstretched palm. Dewey shut his eyes. He kept them shut until he heard the thud snap that announces a rope-broken neck. Like the majority of American law enforcement officials, Dewey is certain that capital punishment is a deterrent to violent crime, and he felt that if ever the penalty had been earned, the present instance was it. The preceding execution had not disturbed him. He had never had much use for Hickok, who seemed to him a small-time chiseler who got out of his depth, empty and worthless. But Smith, though he was the true murderer, aroused another response. For Perry possessed a quality, the aura of an exiled animal, a creature walking wounded that the detective could not disregard. He remembered his first meeting with Perry in the interrogation room at police headquarters in Las Vegas. The dwarfish boy man seated in the metal chair, his small booted feet not quite brushing the floor. And when Dewey now opened his eyes, that is what he saw. The same childish feet, tilted, dangling. Dewey had imagined that with the deaths of Smith and Hickok, he would experience a sense of climax, release, of a design justly completed. Instead, he discovered himself recalling an incident of almost a year ago, a casual encounter in Valley View Cemetery, which, in retrospect, had somehow for him more or less ended the clutter case. The pioneers who founded Garden City were necessarily a Spartan people, but when the time came to establish a formal cemetery, they were determined, despite arid soil and the troubles of transporting water, to create a rich contrast to the dusty streets, the austere plains. The result, which they named Valley View, is situated above the town on a plateau of modest altitude. Seen today, it is a dark island lapped by the undulating surf of surrounding wheat fields. A good refuge from a hot day, for there are many cool paths unbrokenly shaded by trees planted generations ago. One afternoon, the previous May, a month when the fields blaze with the green-gold fire of half-grown wheat, Dewey had spent several hours at Valley View weeding his father's grave, an obligation he had too long neglected. Dewey was 51, 4 years older than when he had supervised the clutter investigation. But he was still lean and agile, and still the KBI's principal agent in western Kansas. Only a week earlier, he had caught a pair of cattle rustlers. The dream of settling on his farm had not come true, for his wife's fear of living in that sort of isolation had never lessened. Instead, the Deweys had built a new house in town. They were proud of it, and proud, too, of both their sons, who were deep-voiced now and as tall as their father. The older boy was headed for college in the autumn. When he had finished weeding, Dewey strolled along the quiet paths. He stopped at a tombstone marked with a recently carved name, Tate. Judge Tate had died of pneumonia the past November. Wreaths, brown roses, and rain-faded ribbons still lay upon the raw earth. Close by, fresher petals spilled across a newer mound. The grave of Bonnie Jean Ishida, the Ishida's elder daughter, who while visiting Garden City had been killed in a car collision. Deaths, births, marriages. Why, just the other day he'd heard that Nancy Clutter's boyfriend, young Bobby Rupp, had gone and got married. The graves of the Clutter family, four graves gathered under a single gray stone, lie in a far corner of the cemetery. Beyond the trees, out in the sun, almost at the wheat field's bright edge. As Dewey approached them, he saw that another visitor was already there. A willowy girl with white-gloved hands, a smooth cap of dark honey hair, and long, elegant legs. She smiled at him, and he wondered who she was. "Have you forgotten me, Mr. Dewey?" "Susan Kidwell." He laughed. She joined him. "Sue Kidwell. I'll be darned." He hadn't seen her since the trial. She had been a child then. "How are you? How's your mother?"
"Fine, thank you. She's still teaching music at the Holcomb School."
"Haven't been that way lately. Any changes?"
"Oh, there's some talk about paving the streets. But you know Holcomb. Actually, I don't spend much time there." "This is my junior year at KU," she said, meaning the University of Kansas. "I'm just home for a few days."
"That's wonderful, Sue. What are you studying?"
"Everything. Art, mostly. I love it. I'm really happy."
She glanced across the prairie.
"Nancy and I planned to go to college together. We were going to be roommates. I think about it sometimes. Suddenly, when I'm very happy, I think of all the plans we made.
Dewey looked at the gray stone inscribed with four names and the date of their death, November 15th, 1959.
Do you come here often?
Once in a while.
Gosh, the sun's strong. She covered her eyes with tinted glasses.
Remember Bobby Rupp? He married a beautiful girl.
So I heard.
Colleen Whitehurst. She's really beautiful. And very nice, too.
Good for Bobby.
And to tease her, Dewey added,
But how about you? You must have a lot of beaus.
Well, nothing serious. But that reminds me, do you have the time?
Oh, she cried when he told her it was past four.
I've got to run. But it was nice to have seen you, Mr. Dewey.
And nice to have seen you, Sue.
Good luck, he called after her as she disappeared down the path. A pretty girl in a hurry, her smooth hair swinging, shining. Just such a young woman as Nancy might have been. Then, starting home, he walked toward the trees and under them, leaving behind him the big sky, the whisper of wind voices in the wind-bent wheat. The end.